Broadcasting live from the Pro Business Channel studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Capital Club Radio, brought to you by Flock Specialty Finance. Please welcome your host, Chairman and CEO, Michael Flock.
Good morning. Welcome to Capital Club Radio. We're delighted today to interview and talk with one of the celebrities in the, the Atlanta journalism circles, David Rubinger, who's currently the publisher of the Atlanta Business Chronicle. I think it's probably the leading commercial journal in Atlanta and one of the most successful in the United States. David worked here, interestingly, as editor in the 1990s. But prior to becoming publisher, David had founded his own PR firm. He ran corporate communications for Equifax and headed the corporate media relations for Ketchum, a global public relations agency. But when David was running his own PR firm, and that's when I met David, he focused on RMA, the Receivables Management Association of America, and that was in the credit and collections industry. He currently serves on the boards of the Metro Atlanta Chamber, the Atlanta Convention and Visitors Bureau, and Emory University's Center for Ethics. So we're thrilled to have David here today.
Oh, thanks, Michael. Good to see you again after all these years.
Yeah, it's been a decade, and I think, time flies. I think we were playing golf at the Atlanta Country Club. It was part of a conference, I think.
Right.
And I just remember, David, though, I think you were a little stingy with the mulligans.
I think it was very true.
So I think we need to have another round.
That sounds
I think
good.
We both have probably improved since then.
The pandemic did a lot for everyone's golf game.
A little bit, yeah.
There you go.
So anyway, one of the objectives on our podcast is to try to connect the dots of our guests to see the intersection between the personal and professional journeys that we're on and what were some of the lessons learned and some of the maybe challenges that we met along the way. So, David, let's start at the beginning. If you were to write an autobiography, how would you start it?
The autobiography would talk about family. It would talk about the ability to connect with not only people in the business community, but people in my broader communities, and how it was those relationships and being surrounded by really smart, interesting people helped move me along in my career. Mm-hmm. When I knew that I was going to get a question about my autobiography, you tend to think back on what happened
right.
in your life.
Right.
And it's been a really interesting, a lot of interesting twists and turns in my life that have led me to where I am today. Mm-hmm. And I'm really happy with how the journey's gone so far.
So as a kid, though, I mean, what were your passions? I mean, were you really into, public relations? You probably...
I wasn't into public relations. Relations was an outgrowth of journalism for me. So little background is I grew up in Manhattan. My parents were, voracious readers of the New York Times. So every morning the New York Times would come to the door. And, as a kid, I would grab it and go immediately to the sports pages and flip through it. And in the weekends, I was always excited to get the New York Daily News, to read the comics and all those things. But there was something about reading the newspaper that gave me the sense of understanding what was going on in the world. I was also a kid who grew up during the age of Watergate.
Right.
So for me, I was about, 8, 9 years old at the time, watching what was going on in our government and how the media interacted with the political system, to me, even at a young age like that, sort of fascinated me. Because it's where I was getting all my information from, whether it was from television or from reading a newspaper. And that sort of was my first experience in understanding the role of the media in our greater society in terms of business and politics and sports and the role that media played in it. And that's been sort of the string that's been a constant all the way through, is the role that media plays in helping us understand what's going on in the world. And today, of course, it's gotten so much more complicated.
Right. And do you feel it's gotten a little more political since those days? Or
I think it's just as political as it was back then. I think what's different is the delivery mechanisms have gotten to be so much more complicated.
Okay.
Back then, you had three networks.
Right.
You had certain newspapers. It was a very static sort of way of getting your information. You chose the information you wanted. You were either a Cronkite guy, a Chancellor guy, a Brinkley guy. Mm-hmm. You had your place that you went. Now, because of the internet and the ability for podcasts and blogs and all these other ways of delivering information,
right,
there are so many divergent
channels
and ways of getting information,
right,
and opinions that it is really blown things out. But I think that's always been part of American society. I mean, you go back to the 18th century, okay? In the 1700s, you had your town criers in the park, and there'd be a town crier on every corner yelling out their political opinion. Mm-hmm. That's no different,
right,
than the blogging that we have going on today.
Okay.
So it's just a question of how we're delivering the information. Human beings haven't changed much. We just have all found new ways to sort of get our messages out, and the megaphones have changed a lot.
So it's the media that changed.
The media and the delivery mechanism
and the delivery
has
of
changed.
That media.
Yeah.
Right.
But that was the start. It was, you know, being born and raised in New York City,
right,
was also a really fertile playground for a young kid to grow,
right,
and get different interests. And I was always fascinated by people and meeting people. And it was a fun way to lead to my craft.
But growing up, then, did you have any dreams of running a newspaper? Did you edit your college yearbook? Or
no, I wanted to be Tom Seaver. I wanted to be a starting pitcher for the New York Mets. That was my dream as a kid. There was nothing to do with. And then after that, once I took up tennis, I thought I could parallel John McEnroe, because he went to my high school. So I thought, oh, I could be like John McEnroe. When I realized I couldn't do that, I moved on.
Right.
The bug for journalism really came in high school. Mm-hmm. I was an editor of my high school paper. And then in college, I was the editor of the college paper.
Okay. So and you did start then.
I did. Yeah. I did. But to me, journalism and writing and working at the newspaper was a way for me to improve my communication and writing skills in class. I was an okay writer.
Uh-huh.
I was not a great writer, but I had an English professor say, you know, you really should go to the newspaper, because at the newspaper, you're going to have to learn to write in succinct fashion to get your point across. And I think that'll help you when you're writing your thesis and your term papers. And it really changed my ability to communicate, writing in what they call the inverted pyramid form of writing the most important facts down to the bottom.
Right.
So, yeah, I was the editor of the college paper. I interned. I was in Hartford, Connecticut at Trinity. Mm-hmm. I then worked at the Hartford Current, which was the daily newspaper in Hartford, for two years while I was in college, and got to learn a newsroom. And that got the bug. And I thought I was going to be a political writer, because that's what my interests were primarily politics. But I also knew that I wanted to move back to New York City. So getting a job covering New York politics is not what you get when you come out of college. Mm-hmm. What was an opportunity for me in the late 80s was to be a business writer. So I was able to start off my career in New York as a business writer and editor for McGraw-Hill, which back then was the grand poobah of business
of
journalism with all the trade publications they had and Standard & Poor's.
Right.
And so that's where I got my start, covering the markets for McGraw-Hill. And it was a great way for me to learn the business. And I say that for the last 30-some-odd years that I've been in business – it's been a constant MBA. I've never gotten an MBA because all I'm doing is talking to people like you who've taught me things, have taught me things about business and about leadership and about finance and about marketing. So I've always feel like I'm constantly getting an education from all the interesting people I get to run across.
Well, you know, you mentioned earlier that you got into networking, developing relationships. And what's interesting then is you kind of transitioned into media and writing, editing, which is another kind of channel to developing that network. So do you find that still the case now that you're a publisher?
I don't edit and write as much as I used to.
Right.
I hope to get back to it at some point. Matter of fact, I've been working on some ideas that I'd like to have be part of the publication. I'm now running the business.
Right.
And by running the business, that means editorial reports to me, advertising reports to me, our events program reports into us, our circulation, anything having to do with the business is my responsibility.
That's your CEO, essentially.
But part of a big company, Atlanta Business Chronicle is one of 44 business journals owned by American City Business Journals, okay, headquartered in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Okay.
They in turn are owned by Advance Publishing, which is the Newhouse family. Mm-hmm. So we're part of a media organization. Mm-hmm. Atlanta is the largest business journal in the company. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of eyeballs are looking at Atlanta from our company to see how we do.
Okay. So and, you set the tone, you set the pace, the vision, and
we try to. I mean, I think it's. I think there are a lot of really talented publishers and editors and executives in this company who help us figure out what's the next great thing for us to do. But this business model is really interesting because I feel like it's a laboratory. It's a nonstop laboratory. We're always experimenting about what you as a reader want from what we produce. Mm-hmm. And it changes every day. And we monitor it every day to make sure we understand what is the type of content that our reader is looking for so that they can grow their business, grow themselves personally. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating that over the 30 years that I've been around Atlanta Business Chronicle in different ways, shapes, and forms, our mission hasn't changed.
What is that mission?
The mission is to help a business or a business person grow.
Okay.
That's what it's all about.
Okay.
It's all about what kind of information can we give you, Michael Flock,
right,
to help Flock become a better company?
Right.
It might be a real estate story. It might be a healthcare story. It might be a technology story. But if it's got information in there that you feel you can take away from and say, that's going to help me do my job better, then we've achieved our goal.
Okay. And don't you have two sets of clients, customers? One is the consumer, right? The reader.
Right.
And then also the PR executives of the firms also that you're trying to help promote. Is that right or not?
Not really. I cater to my reader.
Okay.
First and foremost.
Okay.
Because the reader is my ultimate consumer.
Right.
My advertiser.
Right.
Wants to be a part of our medium.
Right.
Because we attract those readers.
Right.
So it's very important for me to keep, use the term church and state, but you got to keep those two things divided.
Right.
To maintain the integrity.
Right.
Of the product. So that advertisers feel like they're not
right.
That there's a,
they're
that
attracted to Chronicle because you've got a vast base of readers
who are looking for independent information.
Okay,
so the biggest issue is, and a lot in the media, it's happened all over the country, is that oftentimes the media is pay to play. In easier words. In order for you to get into the publication as a subject of an article, you have to buy advertising.
Right.
We don't work that way because our reader is too sophisticated and they know they can tell when something is simply a pay to play exercise. We have sponsored content. You can buy something and put content in, but if it's a story written by one of our writers or editors, it is an independent piece that is not influenced by our advertisers because that's what good journalism is.
Let's jump now to the Receivables Management Association, where you were the kind of head of media communications. Yeah. And many of our listeners to the Flock podcast are from that industry.
Hi, everybody. I miss you.
You were there in what the
– So I left Equifax in 2008. And from 2008 to 2015, I had my own firm.
Right.
And one of my first clients – it was then known as DBA International. Now it's RMA International. Right. And I was brought in to help help position the industry with business media around, the various issues. I helped tell all the positive stories about what was going on in the debt buying industry. I also tried to explain that there were good actors and bad actors in any industry.
Right.
And oftentimes the media would focus on the bad actors.
Right.
And it was my job to bring them back to the important role that debt buyers and debt collectors paid in our credit system.
Yep.
And luckily, coming out of Equifax, I had the knowledge base of understanding how our credit economy worked.
Right.
Because most PR professionals didn't have that base. So I was able to help articulate that pretty well with the Wall Street Journal and Bloomberg and other major outlets to help tell the story. They didn't always buy the story, but at least I felt like I was a credible voice in helping explain it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sometimes it's difficult because that industry, I think, has a mixed reputation, to put it nicely. How did you then, as head of media communications, position the receivables management industry to the broader media? Because it's not easy. It has a stigma. I don't think it's always fair. But in the media world that you were working in, how did you position it? How did you brand it? How did you provide kind of the thought leadership behind the media communications that you were managing?
Well, frankly, I listened very carefully to you and other people who were on the board of DBA mm-hmm. International at the time. I listened to people like Barb Sinsley and Bob Belair and Rich Monroe and mm-hmm. Stacey Schechter and all these people who lived in this industry. And I paid very close attention to how they explained the value proposition, not just to a business, but to the consumer, about why it was important to have bad debt be bought and then resold, because right. it put money back into the economy so that they could that right. banks could keep on lending.
Right.
Otherwise, right. banks, if they just write it off, they're going to increase the cost of the credit, and it becomes more expensive for the consumer in the long run.
Sure.
That's a hard story to tell because it seems very removed. I think for most of us, we just think that debt collectors are bad actors. But at the end of the day, if those debts aren't somehow dealt with, the bank can't make the loans they made before, mm-hmm. and they end up lending less. Mm-hmm. It was always an uphill battle. We were never going to win the war.
Right.
I think you just had to win little battles one by one. Mm-hmm. The key was to take the personality out of it and really try to explain the structure. Mm-hmm. Because once you got into the personality piece, because it was very easy to bring in who the bad actors were.
Right.
There are a
right.
lot of people who
right.
who thrive on the emotion of the negativity around right. debt right. collecting. The key was to say, this is part of the process. It's part of our right. economic system.
Right.
And it's not illegal. It is strictly
no.
what needs to be done so we keep our credit economy going.
Right.
And today, we're looking at a credit economy that's as healthy as it's been in my lifetime.
Yep.
And there seems like all that credit education that's gone on over the last 20 years is finally starting to right. take root, and people right. are starting to right. pay their bills on time.
Right.
I think we're in a better place than we were back in 2008.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And, we laugh, we say that, people in collections, aren't really doing God's work. And, in the past, I think that many of the cowboys in the industry were the ones that drove the headlines. And then the CFPB was created. And I think that kind of changed actually made it more stable, more, ethical. And
I mean, at the time, the CFPB by your industry and right. by my prior employer, Equifax, no one was very excited about having a be regulated.
Right.
No one in enterprise wants to be regulated.
Right.
But sometimes a little regulation goes a long way, as long as it's properly monitored. Mm-hmm. And CFPB, despite some of the sword battles that went on within the industry, right. Probably helped stabilize things a little bit.
Right.
I'm sure there could be more arguments made on both sides of that. But it definitely helped stabilize the ship quite a bit. And listen, the U.S. credit economy is a fascinating story in and of itself. The fact that we can have this ability for consumers to be able to access credit on a credit card and be able to live the lifestyles they want mm-hmm. within reason mm-hmm. Has been a very interesting part of our overall economic system that I don't think there's enough credit given to how successful it's been at making America what it is today.
Definitely. So, David, you've kind of moved back and forth between corporate, entrepreneur, because you had your own PR firm, but you were working with corporations, obviously Equifax, and then Ketchum. So what are some of the lessons learned, and how was that transition that you made? Because it was, entrepreneur, corporate,
right.
entrepreneur. What lessons learned were there, and were they the same
right.
or different?
Lessons learned. So, first of all, the first step was leaving journalism to go into public relations. Mm-hmm. Okay, that was a big step in my life because when you're a journalist, you maintain this degree of independence. When you move to public relations, you're now being paid by corporations to help represent their interests. It's a very different mindset. So I had to wrap my head around that first. And that was a pretty comfortable transition for me because I felt like it was, again, as I said earlier on, that it's all about, I love my continuing education process. I felt like I'd learned as much as I could learn as a journalist. And now I was going to learn as a practitioner of PR consulting. It was my next step in the journey. The movement to Equifax was born out of the fact that working at Ketchum, I was becoming sort of a minor league expert in the world of the credit economy. So now I could grow more by becoming having an expertise, understanding how a credit report is built, understanding how disputes are done, understanding how money is lent and what shows up on a credit report. Not many people know that. So I felt like, again, it was part of my education process.
Right.
Then I went on my own, which was exciting because I'd never run my own business before. And that was just an exciting time in my life. My kids were young. Mm-hmm. My wife, Hetty, is a successful partner at a major law firm here in town. Right. It was an opportunity for me to be home more with my kids and grow a business, which was so exciting. Mm-hmm. I just loved that. And I thought that's what I was going to do for the rest of my career. I really didn't see moving on from that. But in 2015, Atlanta Business Chronicle, I reconnected with Atlanta Business Chronicle when my predecessor, Ed Baker, retired. And they were looking for a publisher. And I didn't know if I wanted to get back into the media business. It had changed so radically. I mean, when I was there originally, it was a newspaper.
Right. Now it's...
Now it's this multimedia platform. The role of the publisher has changed. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't really sure I wanted to come back. But I looked, you know, in the mirror, looked deep down in my own heart and realized that the Business Chronicle was such a big part of who I was when I moved to Atlanta back then, way back then, that coming back to it really felt natural. And it's been a great 5 years. It's really been fascinating. Again, part of the education continues. It just keeps on going. It hasn't stopped. And, you know, I'm excited every day that I go to work there.
You know, a lot of our audience, you know, they've been in receivables management. Some of them, of course, are entrepreneurs. And their lives, their journeys through their careers is never a straight line. There's always bumps along the road. Can you share with us some of your adverse experiences and how you dealt with them?
Sure. Some of the adverse experience that sticks with me the most is more about a life and death thing than anything else. Back in 1992, a reporter who I worked with at the Business Chronicle passed away in a car accident. And I was, you know, at that point, 26, 27 years old, and I felt so on top of the world. Her death and the impact it had on me and everybody else at the Business Chronicle at the time was so powerful that it really changed my outlook on, you know, the seize the day mentality of like, you know, life is too precious. Mm-hmm. You really need to stay focused on what's most important in your life and keep driving in that direction and don't take any of it for granted. So that to me was something we all,
like carpe diem.
It was definitely a carpe diem moment for me. And as that one has stuck with me throughout my life. In terms of other challenges, you know, learning to control what you can control. And when I was working at Equifax, I had to deal with some awful crises for the company, and knowing that maintaining my own emotional equilibrium, understanding that I can only control as much as I can. I can't necessarily change the way everyone looks at this company, but stay focused on short-term objectives, on quick wins. Those are the kind of things. Other bumps along the road, there haven't been too many bumps. I think maintaining the work-life balance with my having four children at home and being a good husband while trying to also be a successful business person has always been paramount to me, because I've seen too many friends have struggles in their personal relationships. I've got to put that piece first always, because they're going to be, no matter what happens in my career, they're always going to be with me to the end of the day. That's always been the most critical piece, is to make sure that I keep that part as smooth as possible all the way through.
You know, as we get to know people, I think one indication of who they are, what their passions are, is revealed in the books that they like to read. What is one of your favorite books you've read in the last few years?
So, of the last few years, I was going to say it was on my nightstand right now.
Okay.
All right. So there's a book on my nightstand right now that I just got. It's called A Course Called America by Tom Coyne. And it's a series of vignettes about golf courses all over the United States. Mm-hmm. We're both golfers. Yeah, we both enjoy golf. Yeah. And to me, it's my great escape. It's a way for me to sort of
relax
yeah. and read interesting stories about mm-hmm. about interesting places. So it's less about the golf and more about the communities where the golf courses are. Mm-hmm. And it's really been a fun read. And what I like about it is when I go, I read all day. And when I go and I get in bed at night and I read, I only like to read I like reading short little snippets. I don't get caught up an entire book at night. Right. So that's been a fun one. I usually am a nonfiction person. Mm-hmm. Again, it goes back to since I was a kid, the type of reading I always liked to do was biographies of interesting and famous people.
It gets back to your networking.
Those are the kind of stories
you don't know,
I like to
but you're networking kind of indirectly.
Yeah. Right. So if I'm reading a book about Abraham Lincoln or Teddy Roosevelt, or I remember as a kid reading a book about W.C. Handy, the trumpet player, mm-hmm. These are books that I always enjoyed reading because I always got to put myself in the shoes of other famous people.
Right.
I think that was one of the things that glommed me onto journalism because I loved reading these stories about how other people tick.
Right. Well, we started our conversation this morning with how you'd start your autobiography. Mm-hmm. How would you write your obituary?
Oh, my gosh. How depressing. Actually, it's really funny because I find that the people who get to write the obituaries for the New York Times have some of the most fascinating jobs in the journalism business, to be candid. So the obituary – I hope the obituary would talk about this – a lot about this path where journalism played such an interesting path. The New Yorker in me, now the Southerner in me. But really the fact that Hetty and I have been able to – raise four amazing kids who are all doing great in life. To me, is just feels really good because mm-hmm. that's the stuff you can't ever predict, right? You hope it's going to work out, but you can't ever predict that piece. So yeah, New Yorker turned Southerner, journalist turned entrepreneur turned publisher, dad, husband, mm-hmm. Lover of Atlanta. Atlanta's a great city.
That's interesting for someone who grew up in Manhattan,
right? Well, I still love Manhattan. Manhattan's a great city, and I love going back to visit. My mom still lives there, and I got a son who lives there now.
Right.
But I've really adopted Atlanta in a special way. It's got a certain quality to it. I've gotten to see, and you're in the same boat as I am. I mean, since we moved here, to see how much Atlanta has evolved mm-hmm. as a city, especially since the Olympics, how diverse it's become, mm-hmm. how progressive it's become, how it has really glommed onto its roots as a civil rights cornerstone for America. How much we still have to learn. Mm-hmm. Remember, this education process, it's not just about business.
Right.
I think we're all having to learn a lot about our own personal education, about dealing with issues of equity and race. The Business Chronicle has changed tremendously in the last year in addressing the issues of equity and race. And I'm so proud of what the newsroom and what we've all done to try to take care of those things because 30 years ago, you would rarely see women or minorities in the Business Chronicle.
Right.
We were a white man's publication. There's no question about it. And now there's been this intentional look at making sure we are really representing the entire business community, not simply the ones of the majority that live in Buckhead mm-hmm. In 30327. We've really tried to get ourselves diversified there. And does that make the most amount of business sense? Mm-hmm. Maybe not short term, mm-hmm. but long term it does because that's how our city is evolving. Mm-hmm. So I've really had fun watching the patchwork of Atlanta evolve over time, and it's been fun. It's been really fun to be a part of that.
So finally, David, what's next for you? What are the next steps for David Rubinger?
Right now, next step is making it through this year. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure that we finish strong. My job is to keep my team focused on creating the best content, delivering on our numbers for our company. I think because we repositioned ourselves in such an interesting way, I think the Business Chronicle has an opportunity for a lot of really cool growth in the next 24 months. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at, that's my horizon right now, is really the next 2 years to see where the Chronicle can go. Mm-hmm. For me personally, we're adapting to being empty nesters. Mm-hmm. My kids, my daughter's a lawyer. My son's in advertising in New York, and I've got twins in college. My wife and I get to know each other again as empty nesters, looking forward to this next stage of life. Uh-huh. We both have thriving careers, so I don't think any of us are looking to hang it up anytime soon. And having the Chronicle as my base to do all these things is, I think, the best job in journalism. I don't think you can find a better place to be in terms of being able to be a part of a community, contribute in your own way, and still have a fun career. Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful, David. Well, thank you for sharing this very thoughtful journey that you've been on in the world of journalism, both how it is today and what I think you think it will become tomorrow, which I think you're going to have a big impact on here in Atlanta. So really appreciate you participating with us today.
And congratulations to you. I mean, it's really been fun to see Flock do as well as it has and how you've thrived through all this craziness that's gone on in the marketplace. You really have a special place in the receivable management business that is very unique, and you've really done a great job building your own brand. Even just doing a podcast, for mm-hmm. God's sake, it's not the kind of thing that's the norm. You're willing to always take it in a different direction, and that's what I told people when I had my firm. That's what you need to do. You need to find ways to help differentiate yourself so that people remember you, remember what you stand for.
Yep.
And that's great for you and for your company. So congratulations to you. And continued
thank
success.
You. I mean, I'm a believer in branding and marketing as a differentiator. So anyway, well, David, thanks again for being with us on Capital Club Radio today. I think the lessons learned that you've shared with us along your wonderful journey in journalism have been outstanding, fascinating, and so we look forward to David's next show with us. I think we'll have some more tales of his success and challenges in the world of journalism here in Atlanta.
Great. Read Atlanta Business Chronicle while you're at it.
Yep. All right. Thanks, David. Thank you.
Thank you for joining Michael Flock and his guests on the Capital Club Radio Show. For more information on future interviews, please visit us at flockfinance.com. This program is brought to you by Flock Specialty Finance, where clients are provided knowledge and insights to grow their business in complex and risky markets. Flock is more than a transaction.